Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
I have never met an adult who is happy to have quit music lessons. Even if you haven't played an instrument since childhood, you might not even be able to read music anymore. But surely you've thought about how great you could be if only you'd kept it up all these years. What if you'd followed the now famous 10,000-hour rule, the one that suggests that if you put in that many hours of practice, you could be a virtuoso? This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest today is the man whose research led Malcolm Gladwell and others to write with much excitement about that rule for mastery, the 10,000-hour rule. But he says many people have somewhat misinterpreted his conclusions. There's nothing magic about 10,000 hours, and while it surely takes a lot of time to gain mastery, just doing it is not enough. You need a special kind of practice and extraordinary motivation. Anders Ericsson is professor of psychology at Florida State University. His new book, written with Robert Poole, is called Peak: Secrets from the New Science of Expertise. Anders, welcome to Think.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Ever since all the 10,000-hour rule stuff emerged, I've been trying to calculate how many hours of interviews I've done and when I might achieve master status. Your research demonstrates, though, that simple practice isn't enough. We need what you call deliberate practice.
Right. And I think if you think about people who play golf on a weekly or even daily basis, they typically don't get better just from playing. And I think what we find is really the key here is the difference between just doing what you normally are doing and what we call purposeful practice, when you pick out some aspect that you're basically involved in what you're doing. And then, ideally, with the help of a teacher, you will be able to identify now the kind of training that would allow you now to improve that particular aspect and then incorporate that in your normal behavior. So when we were kind of talking about sort of amount of practice, we were talking about this kind of practice that music students engage in when they meet with a teacher on a weekly basis, who kind of identifies now, you know, now you need to be working on this particular thing. Here's some music pieces or scales that will really allow you here to kind of improve your ability to kind of play this type of notes. So once you look at that, you know, the kind of systematic, focused training on improving a particular aspect, you see how different that is from, you know, just doing pulling in hours that you do the same job and you pretty much do the same thing over and over.
How did the 10,000-hour rule get attributed to you in the first place?
Well, we did a study where we basically found that when we looked at some elite violinists at a music academy, International Music Academy in Germany, we basically try to track here, you know, how much practice did the very best and also people who accomplished at a lower level within the same academy, just to see here, you know, does practice makes a difference when you're really at the very top? And we found that at age 20, the top group had actually the average of those were 10,000 hours. Now, Malcolm Gladwell misread that and basically thought that all of them had actually surpassed 10,000 hours, but that was an average, so some people actually reported more and some people reported less. And if you're really talking about the international level that Malcolm Gladwell was referring to, which would amount to essentially winning an international piano competition, typically you do that when you're like in the early 30s. So that's 12 years beyond age 20. So we estimate, you know, maybe 25,000 hours would be a good estimate for somebody who is winning an international piano competition.
Is there a point at which practice on any given day becomes useless? Can we over-practice?
Well, I think what we're found is that the very best individuals are very sensitive to being able to kind of put in 100% when they're practicing. So we found our music students would pretty much take a break after 45 to 60 minutes, 10, 15-minute break, and then they would go back to practicing. But we found that nobody was practicing more than 4 or 5 hours a day. It seems that there's a lot of evidence from all sorts of professions like writers, surgeons, and other people that actually being able to sustain that kind of level of concentration for over 4 or 5 hours is really not documented that somebody can do that on a daily basis for extended periods.
So I want to talk about the role of teacher or coach or mentor in helping us achieve our goals. It's always been fascinating to me that there are incredible teachers who have turned out brilliant students who themselves have not necessarily achieved the same level of competency and of mastery as their students. How is that possible? What can the teachers see or do for their students, even if they can't do the same thing themselves?
Well, I think what we're emphasizing is that in a domain like music, where they've been training musicians for centuries, there has evolved kind of insights into how do you actually reach the highest levels. And what I find very important is that you kind of start out with the correct fundamentals, because earlier on it was not infrequent that somebody who had reached kind of an adult level would have to spend a year or two to actually relearn the basics in order to be able to, you know, increase their performance so they could do the really technically challenging sort of performances.
Let's talk about young Mozart, who over time has come to seem really supernaturally gifted if you read accounts of him as a child. With what we can know definitively about his upbringing, what can you guess about how he was able to achieve so much at such an early age?
Well, we've been looking at a lot of individuals, and I think Mozart comes to mind as somebody who seemed magically able to produce music that really has moved people. And one of the things that people don't emphasize is that Mozart's father was a musician, and he's actually famous for his innovation in order to come up here with exercises for children that would actually allow young children to actually be able to play music in an impressive way. So Mozart and his older daughter, older sister, are really examples here of Wolfgang's kind of father's teaching methods. And in our book, we kind of talk about some of the attributes that people have pointed to that seem inexplicable. And one is this ability that some individuals have that when you hear a tone, you can actually name the note. So that would be essentially somebody hitting a key on a piano, and you could actually tell exactly which of the keys was being hit. Now, more recent research have basically asked, you know, because it turns out that adult musicians who try to acquire this ability find that it's nearly impossible to do, or at least extremely difficult. And what research kind of implies is that when young children in the ages between 3 and 5, they have now kind of a brain that is receptive to learning the skill of actually analyzing tones in isolation. And there is, we talk in the book about the study by a Japanese researcher who demonstrated that if you take a random group of children and give them training between ages 3 and 5, they will all acquire perfect pitch, suggesting, along with a lot of other evidence, that this is something that anyone can acquire as long as you have that training when the brain is in a particularly receptive state. Once you get older, the brain doesn't seem to basically allow for this tweaking. So you may have heard of the bent twig, where if you bend a growing twig, you know, you can actually get a lot of difference here in the final growth of the branch. And that seems to be the true about the brain as well, that certain kind of practice activities at certain ages allows the brain here to develop and then exhibit abilities that, you know, we as adults find amazing.
One thing that certainly the young Mozart had was this, you know, passion to practice. I mean, his father may have put a lot of pressure on him, but you can't put enough pressure on a person to make them a genius, can you?
I'm really glad you're raising this issue. And And I personally think that this is a danger of misinterpreting some of the things that we're finding about experts. And that is that when you're trying to develop a young child that will eventually turn into a mature musician or a mature individual in any kind of domain of expertise, you really need to raise them so they can become independent. And actually, in some ways, once you've reached the level of your teachers and your parents, you will be able to kind of monitor and keep your development of your abilities under your own control. And I think in order to actually develop individuals like that, if you impose a lot of pressure and force them to practice maybe more than they are willing to do, I think what you're more likely to have happen is as soon as they have the degree of freedom of stop, they are basically going to stop. And they really haven't developed now this kind of personal ability here of enjoying the music and being in control of their own development. They've sort of relied too much on the parents' directions. So once they kind of are on their own, then basically there's really nothing to motivate them to kind of keep working and improving. And that's one reason why a lot of prodigies never really make a mark on the music world. They somehow, as long as they are kind of guided by their parents and they're young, they're technically very proficient. But when they actually get to the point here where they're looking for, you know, making their own unique contribution to the domain, then they really don't have the tools for actually continuing that developmental process.
We're speaking with Anders Ericsson, professor of psychology at Florida State University and author of the book Peak, Secrets from the New Science of Expertise.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program, where students can customize their degree, like Lonnie Gentry, pursuing healthcare leadership and ethics. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Florida State University psychology professor Anders Ericsson, author of the new book Peak, Secrets from the New Science of Expertise. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink. Anders, another important element of expertise, the development of expertise, is the ability to form mental representations of what we're trying to do. What does that mean exactly?
Well, I think what we find, and that may be surprising to some, that even in sports and in music, your ability to actually visualize or image what it is that you're trying to accomplish is really critical. So if you, for example, you're a musician and you want to prepare a piece for a public performance, what you basically tend to do is to develop, maybe by listening by other performances, to decide what is it that you want to communicate to the audience. Now, once you've kind of decided what you want to do, now you have to translate that into basically hitting the keys. But as you're actually playing, a skilled musician would be able to hear, you know, basically what it sounds like and what the audience would experience. But that allows them then to compare, what does it sound like when I play it, and what is it that I would like it to sound like? So you kind of get a feedback loop. But all of this is kind of happening in the mind of the pianist. And often they have to sort of solve problems because they want to play at a faster rate, and then they have to change fingering so that, you know, basically which finger hits which key. So there's a mental process involved in music, and we see the same thing when it comes to sports, that in order to be able to do the right action when you are on the competitive basketball court or football field, that requires you being able to be aware of what it is that the different players on your team as well as the opposing team are about to do. And building up that kind of mental model of essentially what is happening on the field right now, so you can identify now what is the most appropriate thing that you would be doing at that moment. And we find that, you know, the difference between the best and the sort of sub-elite and even worse, lies very much in this cognitive ability of being able to perceive the current situations and be able to select now the correct action that will help your team.
It's really remarkable how much better elite athletes get over time. And some of that may have to do with, you know, better nutrition or, you know, better resources, that sort of thing. But some of it clearly is mental. And you write about this swimmer named Natalie Coughlin, who was always a good swimmer, but used to practice sort of mostly with her body and then made this change to also practice with her mind.
Right. And basically, I think as a swimmer, you need to have the feedback of the feeling of the water. And only if you're paying attention now to what is really happening with your body and how you can transfer the power to basically the water, which is essentially going to lead you to be able to swim faster. And for her, it was sort of a realization here of how important it was to actually put in that extra effort and being able to translate that into how she would actually modify her swimming to attain certain kinds of feelings.
So if you are drawing a picture or hitting a tennis ball or playing a sonata, you do have instant feedback. You know if you've made a mistake, and if you're so inclined, you can take steps to fix it. What if you're, say, a surgeon and, you know, you operate on someone and you won't know for weeks until that patient has healed that you could have done something better in, you know, operating on their knee or something?
Yeah, I think that happens a lot, you know, in medicine where you meet patients and you try to diagnose and then come up with a treatment that's appropriate for them. And doctors do the best they can, but as you were saying here, the final diagnosis often takes a long time. So what we propose here is, especially when it comes to training doctors, that you would actually record previous cases. So if you have an x-ray, you would, instead of basically analyzing a current patient, you would actually have an old case where we actually know what the correct diagnosis was. And then if we have a library of such x-rays, you would be able to, in an afternoon, encounter all sorts of particular situations, and especially if you have a difficulty identifying a certain type of problem, you would have 10, 14 cases. And if you had to wait until you experience that in a normal clinic, you may have to wait 10 years. Hmm. So basically, by structuring now the learning environment to actually allow you that immediate feedback about what the correct action is, then there's clear evidence here how you can improve the efficiency of the training.
It's interesting because it's different from the kind of continuing education that a lot of doctors do, which is attending a conference and hearing a lecture or, you know, reading a medical journal. This is really learning by doing.
Right. And there's really compelling research that shows that if doctors attend these sort of lectures, there's really no impact on their daily training. So what now educators have done is to help the doctors, you know, look at their daily practice and then specify what is it that they should be doing different to capitalize on this new knowledge about how you can actually improve the outcomes of patients. So basically that step of identifying it, and then maybe you also need to train to be able to do this new procedure or this modification of the procedure. So this idea of just knowing is very far from what we're emphasizing, namely your ability to perform and basically relate that to meaningful outcomes like the outcomes of your patients.
So I might tell you that I want to learn Russian or to play the violin or to be an incredible tennis player, but obviously I don't want it enough to put in the effort. What's the difference between people who do and don't find it within themselves to put in this kind of purposeful practice?
I think that's a great question and a challenging one. I believe that motivation, especially for adults who want to basically acquire a new skill, you have to start with the motivation. And I guess I would want to point to maybe a case here where, you know, you have a child and you want to have some alone time with that child. And I guess that could be surrounded now by learning to play an instrument or learning, you know, some kind of sports skill. And I believe that now drawing on the enjoyment that you would have of being able to learn that child and actually help that child develop skills, that is going to be the kind of effect here that is going to motivate you to kind of keep going. And I think when it comes to other skills, I think there's some really intriguing effects here from maybe only training for about a couple of hundred hours, that you can actually become a pretty good person drawing. And I know that there are kind of courses where you can actually now draw comic strips or basically thank you cards and other kinds of things. And you're actually able to develop, as long as you now, submit to this organized training where you're actually building up skills from the bottom up and then sustain that. And I guess the key is, don't overdo it, because I think one of the real challenges with a lot of people who want to, attain some skill is that they want to do it in, a couple of weeks or a couple of months. But if you think about it, if you look at those kind of really outstanding performers and how long it took for them, why would it be possible for you to acquire those kinds of skills so much faster than, the really top performers when they went through this developmental process?
Drawing is a really interesting example, because these days most of us in Western society think you either can or cannot do it. You can maybe improve your skill, but you have to start with the ability. People in the 19th century learning to draw and sketch things that they encountered in the world was like part of an education. And nobody assumed that they could not be taught or could not practice over time and gain skills.
Yeah, and I think that's really interesting, because when it comes to actually acquiring skills of drawing, and there's going to be some involvement of copying, and I think there's this idea here that if you want to be truly creative, you can't basically copy. What we find is that when we look at the most creative painters like Picasso, he actually acquired all the basic skills. So he was traditionally highly skilled and could do all the kind of techniques that previous painters were able to do. And that brought him now to the kind of frontier of painting. So he would be able to kind of know here that he was now taking a step into a new territory that hadn't really been, visited by previous artists.
I was also interested to read that Benjamin Franklin taught himself to write by copying other people.
And I think, again, here, when it comes to writing, I think there should be much more emphasis here in helping individuals to kind of acquire the right kind of technique. And what Benjamin Franklin did, and I think now with our, computer-based resources, we could do a whole lot better job, but he basically, found articles that he basically read, and then he actually tried to rewrite them. So he basically was able now to kind of put in his own words what he could remember, and then he could compare, his rendition with the target article, and then he could iteratively, learn. And I think that idea here of basically learning by identifying kind of differences and then gradually being able to understand, why a good author was constructing a sentence in a particular way, that art form of that kind of cycling through is something that I think our educational system could really learn or really be improved. And I've talked to some teachers here of creative writing, and what they say is it's much better to write short things and then get personalized individual feedback during a course than doing, which is the traditional way, where you write maybe one or two papers, and then you'd get feedback, but you don't really now take that feedback and revise it until, you basically have a product which is sort of the best that you could accomplish on a given topic.
Anders Ericsson is my guest. He's professor of psychology at Florida State University and author of Peak, Secrets from the New Science of Expertise. We'll resume our conversation with him in a few minutes. If you'd like to join it, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. Before we open those lines and actually talk to those folks, we are hoping that you will call 1-888-694-6931 or go online to kera.org to show your support for Think, for Public Radio, for KERA specifically. We started Think today looking for 40 contributions. We have 19 left to go. So thanks. Two folks called, and maybe it was Dr. Russell Gregory in Louisville and Ross Eastland of Highland Village, got us under the 20 mark, and we would love to get under the 10 mark in the next couple of minutes here. Your contribution will be instrumental in that.
Other people whose contributions were instrumental are Henry Gorman and Howe, Beth Heideck in Frisco, and Diane Feldman in Arlington. They were able to find a few minutes to support their local public radio station. And when they do, and when we read those names, obviously part of it is to thank those people sincerely for contributing. But also it's a little bit to, you know, challenge people who haven't contributed yet. You know, we always like to read the names of the towns of where people are from. If you haven't heard your town yet on this drive, maybe you can be the first person. But also, it also shows that it's important that we hear from listeners all across North Texas's listening area. You know, the station broadcasts to something like 30 counties. I mean, it's a really big footprint here in North Texas. And it's important that we hear from folks from all across that footprint, because it's through that collective, contributions that we're able to raise the money necessary to keep things strong here at KERA.
This might be the drive where you decide to become a Friends level member of KERA. You can do this online or at 1-888-694-6931. $125 a month is the contribution that gets you there. It is surprisingly affordable for a lot of people who really love the station and want to, really establish a giving relationship. We have some higher levels as well, but, sometimes the Friends level membership is kind of your entree into being a larger scale supporter of KERA. We're also happy to have your membership if you join us at $5 a month or $10 a month. We recognize that people have different resources. We know that all of you who listen value KERA, though. So to the extent that you can sort of look at your listening and put a price on it, we would love to hear from you now, because this money is paying for the content that you rely on.
And there's actually a cool effect that happens when you join the station. Whether it's at the Friends level or at any level, you know, between zero and there, I guess, when you take that step and become an actual investor in the station, so from becoming, let's say, a passive listener to an active investor, you'll find that you listen more because you want to know what your money is going to. That's only natural. We all do that when we spend money on something. We pay a little more attention to it. And what I think that you'll find is that actually listening more just obviously, on the one hand, gives you more of the station that you've grown to love, but it also, you just are going to end up enriching your life so much more. And I would like to think that you'll learn that your investment is actually really paying off. I would ask you to take that challenge by making a contribution and just see if it makes you listen more. I bet you that it does. 888-694-6931 or online at kera.org is how you can do that. While you're on the website, take a look at the new thank you gifts that are available during this drive. Lots of cool new coffee mugs and t-shirts. And go ahead and make that contribution.
The other benefit of being a KERA member in good standing is that you don't feel that sort of sheepish, maybe embarrassment, maybe guilt when we have the pledge drives. The truth is, we are legitimately not trying to make anybody feel guilty. We are trying to inspire you to make a contribution. Those are two different things. But when you hear the drive and you've already set up your membership, you know, you can think, oh, yes, I hope you, my friends and neighbors, will join me in supporting this station. It's a surprisingly good place to be. You feel like you're part of the team. And you really are part of the team, because there are the folks that, you know, work here. And then there are the people who pay for this content to be produced. And we couldn't do it without you, without your money.
And you're the people that keep KERA commercial free as well. You know, when you tune into KERA, you're just hearing nothing but programming. You're hearing the Think Show. And then after this, you're going to hear The World and Fresh Air and All Things Considered all through the night with the BBC. That programming costs money. It's money that we're very happy to spend because we know how valuable it is. And we're able to do that through your contribution. So when you contribute at 888-694-6931 or online at kera.org, your money is going directly into that programming that you enjoy so much each and every day.
And I've neglected to mention that we have thank you gift copies of Anders Ericsson's new book, Peak: Secrets from the New Science of Expertise. If you'd like to read it, want to support KERA at the same time, make a contribution at or above the level of $10 a month now at kera.org or 1-888-694-6931.
The Amon Carter Museum of American Art presents a screening of the 1941 Western film They Died With Their Boots on Sunday, April 10th at 1:30 p.m. Prior to the film, curator Maggie Adler highlights the museum's Western collection, artworks in the exhibition American Epics, Thomas Hart Benton and Hollywood, and the romanticized aspects of the American West. Reservation details at cartermuseum.org, presented in part by Bank of America and Humanities Texas.
PRI's The World brings you more than just today's news.
I had an interview once, and the guy said, so what was it like taking the cameras to your village and the elders seeing these cameras for the first time? You know, these soul-capturing contraptions, you know, how did they feel about that? You know, we've had TV there for like 60 years.
I'm Marco Werman. Join us and hear The World.
Weekday afternoons at 2 on KERA 90.1.
The news can sometimes be overwhelming.
Hollande said France was under attack.
A mass shooting in San Bernardino.
A police officer killing a child.
More than 2 degrees Celsius above what it was.
Total and complete shutdown of Muslims.
Syrian refugees here being put under a magnifying glass.
All Things Considered is here to help you make sense of it all. Listen every afternoon.
Weekday afternoons from 4 to 6:30 on KERA 90.1.
Financial news changes by the very minute. Domestic and global markets are crazy.
China's not about to move away from buying U.S. treasuries.
The European Central Bank wading into the Spanish and Italian government bond market today.
The whole debt ceiling debate made us look dysfunctional. We all know that.
That's okay, though, because we're here. Marketplace. It's the business show for the rest of us. It's from APM, American Public Media.
Weeknights at 6:30 on KERA 90.1.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can customize your master's degree to distinguish yourself in the workplace. You can apply now for summer. Deadline is May 1st. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Anders Ericsson, professor of psychology at Florida State University and author of the new book, Peak: Secrets from the New Science of Expertise. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org. Anders, what does your research suggest about the way we teach school, children in school? Could we incorporate something like deliberate practice and mental modeling into regular schoolwork?
I think that is something that I'm very excited about, the possibility of actually teaching children the benefits of focused training, where they can actually learn now the more generalizable kind of skill of acquiring. Because I think the principles underlying acquiring expertise in a particular domain actually transfer when you're actually trying to achieve a very high level in a different domain. And I think if there was a possibility here of helping children get that experience in one domain at least, that would be key. And I personally think that a lot of the education is maybe focused too much on knowledge that you're then being tested on. And I think the research kind of implies that, you know, if you just memorize information, it's going to be lost within a couple of years. Instead, if you were focusing in on developing your ability to think and reason, I think that would have a much more lasting impact and would kind of prepare you for, you know, your adult life. I think there's some really interesting work, especially in how you can improve physics education at the college level. And and several investigators have kind of demonstrated that instead of actually having lecturers give the same lecture every year, you have the students actually see a video of the lecture before you actually meet with the students. And the actual class time is now dedicated to working out and reasoning about how to apply these ideas to real-world issues.
Hmm. So the flipped classroom model at the university level.
Right. And I think the more that you can make children active, you know, where they're actually producing, writing, and we talked about drawing earlier, and then actually, you know, helping them with feedback so they can actually, you know, have that sense of accomplishment where they would be able to sort of, you know, produce, you know, pieces of art and being able to convincingly, you know, argue for various points here and you know, email messages or other media.
All right, let's go to the phone now. We will speak with James in Saginaw. Hi, James.
Hi, Chris. Love the show.
Thanks.
Yeah, you're one of the reasons we always donate to KERA.
Oh, so thank you.
Yeah, my question regards scaffolding. So we're talking about developing expertise, and I guess my question is about how do you teach people to develop expertise? So there's the developmental psychologist, Lev Vygotsky. He talks about the zone of proximal learning, which is what are the things that people can do if they have expert coaching and help. And I work with couples as a couple therapist, and I always tell them my job is to work myself out of one. So, you know, I'll explain the theory, I'll model it for them, I'll have them practice it. But I guess just this, are there resources, and maybe the book has a lot of that, of how do you teach people to develop competencies themselves.
Thanks for your call.
I think that is the ultimate goal of actually helping individuals develop these mental representations where, you know, initially when you start out in a domain, a teacher will be able to point out aspects that you can kind of change and improve. But eventually you develop the representation where you can actually do that yourself. And I think I agree here with this, you know, general framework where, you know, the teacher is really working on getting to a point here where the individual can actually do the training themselves, and especially if they want to go beyond what the teacher can do, you know, developing these representation that allow them to think and reason about possible ways in which they can keep improving, and I think that by looking at a lot of these changes as actually taking more time, so the teacher actually can give the individuals a realistic assessment here of, you know, how much time and what pace should I select here to be able to really accomplish these intermediate steps? Because only then will you actually help the individual have a realistic idea about what they need to do. And then as a teacher, you would be able to kind of maybe help them also with the motivational aspect of encourage them to, you know, keep on the path here. The journey here to, you know, basically that state of independence where they are able now to deal with all the problems by themselves.
What does all this suggest about motivating reluctant or discouraged learners? You know, people have to learn things that they don't necessarily have any particular interest in. How do you convince somebody who's really struggling that the effort of deliberate practice and mental modeling will pay off?
Well, you know, I believe that as much as possible, you should try to find now a meaningful context within which you would motivate individuals, or they would be motivated to acquire the skills. So the more that you as a teacher would be able to actually demonstrate how math would actually be helpful for these individuals in some real world context, I think that would be sort of a step in the right direction, and would also potentially now with computers and all sorts of programs, you could present students with real world situations where they would actually be able to see how the knowledge and the methods that you're trying to teach them actually would have real world consequences.
All right, I want to talk about the value of deliberate practice, even if we don't want to pursue something to the point that we become experts, right? Like, I might like to be a better cook. I can tell you right now that I don't want to put in thousands of hours of work with a coach. Is it important to do it even if I decide I'm okay with a certain plateau?
For sure. And I think that is, and I believe that motivation and aspiration is something that changes as you yourself develop, and you may actually see now possibilities of how you might get even better. Hmm. But starting this kind of, you know, journey that you kind of write down and commit to, you know, thousands of hours of training, I don't believe that that's maybe the most productive way. Instead, starting with some more immediate consequences and pick out maybe some particular food that you're really excited about, and then actually focus in on preparing one or two dishes, and then basically use that as a mechanism by which you can kind of refine your skills. Only at that point, you may actually feel that you want to go beyond. But I think by partitioning kind of this journey into manageable portions where you can actually have a map for where you want to get to, and then you can decide here, you know, are you willing to go a couple of, you know, steps further to kind of reach an even higher level?
How do you apply this research to the kind of work you do, where you can do experiments and studies, but the kind of feedback isn't quite as direct as it might be in some other fields?
Well, I think that's a really good and interesting question. And I would argue that deliberate practice is the most effective here in terms of acquiring skills that are already known. So learning methods here for doing experiments and stuff like that. When it comes to that point here where you actually have reached now and sort of mastered the techniques that are available, that's when you get now to the more exciting point where you can now try to push that into answering questions that really weren't known. So you're in some ways now have to, you know, search creatively for new answers. And that you can do more effectively if you've mastered all the prerequisite skills. So I guess in the case of Picasso, knowing, you know, so you could actually reproduce all the art here that people have previously done actually puts you in a position here of actually finding new sort of directions and a new way of thinking about art that really, you know, makes a huge difference in your domain.
Anders Ericsson is professor of psychology at Florida State University. His new book, written with Robert Poole, is called Peak: Secrets from the New Science of Expertise. Anders, thank you so much for making this time for us.
Oh, it was a pleasure talking to you.